We talk about homeostasis, we're talking about keeping constant internal conditions. Things we need to maintain. We have to maintain temperature, pH. These things help our enzymes function properly. We pick optimized times, optimized temperatures, optimized pHs. Other things that we need to keep regulated are blood sugar, O2 and CO2 in our blood. We have to maintain food for ourselves. We have to maintain oxygen for ourselves. We saw in our fun little movie how those cells die when they aren't given enough oxygen, given enough food, okay, enough sugar. We have to maintain water levels, or mostly water, and water can travel across that membrane. It can easily be pulled across that membrane, so we need to keep water levels relatively constant. We also need to keep the levels of salts constant. We're going to talk about sodium and potassium in particular when we talk about the nervous system. We're going to talk about action potentials for, but we will need to know about sodium and potassium. How do we maintain this balance in our body? Well, we have to eat lunch. So apparently we're eating Joe College's lunch, okay? The first thing we'll talk about is blood sugar. Blood sugar is a pretty complex system. Glucose in general, keeping these glucose levels constant. You have to have blood sugar that's high enough that your body will be able to grab and pull glucose across. But you don't want it to be so high that your cells can't pull all the glucose across and you get rid of, urinate some of it. These are sugars. They're going to stay in the water. So when you rid yourself of excess water, that sugar will go out right with it. Right out with it. You don't want that to happen. So we've got to find this healthy medium, this balance. After you eat, you bring in a whole lot of sugar. You're digesting this food. You're getting a lot of sugar through. Our pancreas then says, hi, sugar. Pancreas releases insulin to have your body pull sugar into cells as glycogen. If it's low, pancreas, after a while, you pull this in, you get low blood sugar. The pancreas is going to release glucagon to break that glycogen down. Before I go any further, remember when we were talking about short-term storage in the animal body? We talked about glycogen. We're coming back to that. It's a carbohydrate. When we eat, we have high sugar in our blood. We have high glucose levels in our blood. The pancreas releases insulin so that we pull glucose into our cells. We use the glucose we need as glucose because it's there. The rest of it we store as glycogen for short periods of time. So we short-term store it as glycogen. If we have low blood sugar, the first thing our body does is the pancreas says, eat up that glycogen, make it into glucose. So we release this hormone called glucagon to break down that glycogen. The important thing about this is when we're at a high station, we have an effect, but we're at a low station, we have an effect. My questions on the exam will not ask you to memorize the different names of these. You already have to know the name glycogen. You should already know glucose. I won't ask you glucagon. If I do say something about glucagon, I will provide you with a quick definition of it. We balance out with these two, but what happens when we run out of this short-term storage with glycogen? Okay, what do we do when we run out of that? We go for fat. Number one, if we have too much glycogen, our body changes it to fat. Why do we want to change it to fat? What did we remember about fat? How many calories per gram is that? None. Glucose or glycogen is a carbohydrate. How many calories per gram? So what does this fat get us? More calories per unit of space, per unit of mass. Way more profitable, way better, because we don't want to be carrying around twice the weight. We don't want to be carrying around twice the weight unless we have to, in order to run away from whatever's chasing us. If we've got too much, we turn it into fat. If we have too little, we have to access fat to get energy. Another part of that is, that's when we get hungry. Our body says, hey, we've got this glycogen stored as fat. I want to keep that as long as possible. We get hungry so that we seek out a new meal. Because if we can find a new meal, we want to save that fat for when we really need it. Later on, when we're starving, we may really need that fat. So we want to keep it around. We're going to provide ourselves with a normal meal if we can. And if we can't, that's when we'll dive into the fat stores. This is that transfer from fat is a slow process. It's got to go through a lot of changes, right? We remember seeing those lipids those CH chains, turning those into those CH2O chains, those carbohydrates, takes work. It takes time. So it's not an immediate process like changing glycogen. Sometimes we see athletes saying that there's that lull period, that tough period. That's when they're running out of their glycogen stores and they're trying to transfer fat over. Aerobic training builds your glycogen stores. You have larger glycogen stores in your muscles. That means you can go longer before you access fat.
Like running. Yeah, cardio.
So that's going to reduce the chance of you needing to access those fat stores. That doesn't mean you can't possibly access those fat stores. In fact, you probably will if you continue to do high levels of aerobic exercise. But your body doesn't necessarily want to. The reason for that is when you're running from a predator, you don't want to get tired all of a sudden. You don't just want to crap out and fall down. Then you're dead. Yeah, your body does try and maintain a constant pH balance, but the interesting thing is blood pH and pH inside the cells and pH inside of different parts of the cells are not always regulated at the same level. You have those lysosomes that are sometimes more basic, in some areas more acidic. It just matters where you are in the body, so that's why you don't talk about like a set pH for the body. But our next example would be body temperature. We see how we access this energy and how we transfer through it. When we use up a bunch of sugar, we've got to access more. So what are we doing? We are in a negative feedback loop. Okay, and we're going to talk about these. But as time, blood sugar, over time, we eat. We have normal blood sugar, then we eat, our blood sugar goes up. Our body releases, our pancreas releases insulin, blood sugar goes down. Okay, blood sugar gets low, okay, we pull a lot of it in, our pancreas is going to release glucagon to bring that blood sugar back up. So we see it balancing back. So we go up, we pull it into the cell, we go down, we pull a little bit out of the cell, we balance out this blood sugar, we access fat to increase, we balance it out. We try and maintain it at this relatively constant level. We spike. We can and will spike. Sometimes it will go up, sometimes it will go down, above or below that norm. But our body is doing its best to maintain that norm over time. Eat, it goes up, pull it into the cell, start to do something energetic, goes down more, we've got to bring it back up by accessing fat. We're trying to maintain homeostasis.
So we're using negative feedback.
I'll talk more about negative feedback in just a few seconds, okay? But this is an initial example of negative feedback. Our next example is going to be body temperature and maintaining this homeostasis. Average body temperature for the average person, 98.6 or 37 Celsius. What does that really mean? That's the median.
That's in the middle of the bell curve. Does that mean it's not okay to be
99 degrees Fahrenheit as your normal temperature?
No.
You can be a little bit of flux. That's why we don't say that people have temperatures until they're reaching a few degrees past this.
Usually 101 is when we really say they've got a true fever.
We've got this kind of range. Now, we're going to talk about basing it off the 98.6. We're going to say we have an individual and their average body temperature is set for 98.6. Like I said, it's okay. If your set body temperature is basically always 99 or always 98, okay? Some people run hot, some people run cold. So, how does your body maintain this temperature? What does our body do when we're cold? We shiver. What are we doing here? We're burning energy, we're moving muscle cells, we're causing friction.
Friction causes heat.
Energy transfer, remember, whenever we're burning energy, we're burning it, we're releasing heat. So we shiver, we're releasing heat when we're doing that.
We also redirect blood. Why is it easier to get frostbite in your fingers and your toes? Because we redirect blood from these extremities. We tell our body to stop putting blood out there because we have higher surface area. When we reduce the surface area, we reduce the amount of blood that's going out to the entirety of the body.
Less surface area means less contact with the outside world. Less contact with the outside world means the blood is cooling less.
When blood comes in contact with thin layer, there's not a whole lot of meat here, right, on this hand. Thin layer, temperature transfer happens more easily. So, what do? Don't let blood go there. Reduce the blood flow, okay? Greatly reduce the blood flow. All of a sudden, you're not losing as much temperature out of your hands.
So we redirect that blood back to the body core. We keep it in a central area that has less access,
that the external temperature has less access to.
There we go.
All right? Less access to.
So it's intermixing with itself and maintaining the temperature that it's at. More effective. We burn fat for heat. We just straight up burn the fat.
We don't use it for anything. We just get rid of it. The same way that we were talking about just a few moments earlier. When you do chemical changes, you release some of it as heat.
We just start doing chemical changes to release this as heat. So what do? Shiver, bring everything in, reduce blood to the extremities, and we start burning fat to warm up.
Because the arteries have little muscular walls, you can dilate them or constrict them. So you can constrict the arteries and say, in the extremities, anywhere in your body, but it's kind of hard to, you can't consciously do it.
Yeah.
They actually shrink a bit.
Okay. The muscles flex, the diameter reduces, less blood flows through. Here's another thing we do. When you get cold, you get goosebumps. This is great if you've got a lot of fur, and it's horrible if you're like us, basically hairless. There are two uses for goosebumps. Number one, insulation. It makes that cold temperature be further away from you.
Okay? So there's less contact between blood and the cold temperature. Those hairs, they can get cold. Who cares? That's what fur does. Basically like a big insulator, like a big blanket.
Things that have a lot of fur, when they get cold, pull that hair up so that they have a further distance between themselves and the outside world. They'll also thicken it.
Okay? Winter coats on your cat or on your dog.
The other use of this photoerection of having goosebumps, there are two out there evolutionary uses for this. Number one is staying warm.
Number two is a very mammalian response, a fight or flight response. Predators try not to eat or fight things that are as big or bigger than them. Why? They're more likely to be hurt by something that is large or bigger than them, right? You pick on the small ones. You pick on the weaker ones.
Well, when you push this hair up, it makes you look bigger, makes you puff up, all right?
So, if you ever scare your cat, you see those Halloween pictures of cats with their hair standing straight up? What's it actually doing? It's trying to look big. It's saying, hey, I'm big, you're not going to be able to eat me. You won't be able to take me out, okay? That's what it's doing, but it doesn't realize that. It's still really scared.
It's also a fear reaction. Okay, so we see two reasons for this happening. The important one for our discussion is the temperature one, but realize that there are other times that this happens. That's why when you get excited sometimes, your hair will stand on end. When you're scared, a cat, people will do that.
Dogs too.
Yeah, dogs will.
The back of their head.
Any mammal will. Yeah, the raising their cackles is...
Yeah, they're good. Yeah. Back
yeah. And you see that actually in other animal types. But in different ways. There are plenty of lizards and reptiles in the Sonoran Desert that we live in that pop up.
Great horned lizard
does that. Puffs up to scare away potential predators, big snakes.
Oh, I can't fit that. I'm not going to be able to swallow that guy. I'm leaving.
So it's a pretty good defense tactic as well. But when we're cold, we're always puffed up, we're always bigger. We're providing ourselves with more space from that external, very cold world. Even birds do this. Birds like to do this more, the fluffing out for heat, than mammals do. Why? They want to retain as much of this fat as possible because that fat is what they use to fly long distances in these cold temperatures. So usually they need all the fat they can get. So what do? They make themselves have a bigger coat. They basically get themselves a bigger winter coat. This is a female cardinal that's warm, and now look at her when she's cold. Poof. Poof. Look at how big she is. She's not fat. She's not fat. She's just really cold. Alright? She's just cold, so she's just puffing out. Alright? You see this in a lot of birds. Like I said, that fat is much more important for love for flying. Okay? You need lots and lots of energy to fly. Okay, chickadees, they do it too. Okay, we're going to keep going with temperature regulation. Okay, so we thought about fluffing. Now we've got, what does our body do if we're too warm? So we see what we do if we're too cold. We do all these processes, we fight back against it.
If our body temperature is going down, we fight back against it to bring it back to a norm.
What's our body do if we're too warm? Sweat. We redirect blood to the surface of the skin and extremities. We get flush to release,
to let that air take away more of the heat.
Why do we sweat? We're actually letting water change state from a liquid to a gas. That takes a fair amount of energy. We're letting that water evaporate. We're letting it change state. That's very good in releasing energy. We also slow down our metabolism. We're not digesting as well. We're not burning as much. We're trying to just burn in those things that we need to, our muscles. Okay, so we start slowing down the other parts. So what are the components of this feedback system? So we're talking about this feedback. So we've got temperature regulation. We're doing things to warm up when we're cold. We're doing things to cool off when we're warm. How do we control this? How do we pick? How does our body go, oh, I need to shiver? You don't consciously say, man, I would like to be shivering right now. Do you? No. Your body doesn't. How does your body do it? A feedback system, okay? A feedback system. So I'm going to hide the negative feedback for a second. First off, we need a sensor. The sensor senses the state of the system. The system is you. When we're talking about temperature regulation, the system is you. It is measuring the state of the system. Whatever system we're talking about, sensor. Then we've got the integrator. In most cases, it is the brain. Not always, but most cases, the brain. Determines the appropriate action, okay? To go back to the desired state, or to push towards the desired state. It chooses what to do. Chooses. Last, we have an effector. It affects the system. It affects the state of the system, modifies it, bringing it back or further from whatever it was before, depending on which type of feedback we're talking about. So, we've got a sensor that measures the state of the system. We've got an integrator that chooses what to do. And then we've got an effector that affects the system. Okay, the components of the temperature system in humans. The sensor for this would be your nerves.
Sensory nerves sense what's happening. So we have these nerves sensing exactly what's happening with our body.
So what will be this integrator? The brain. Like I said, oftentimes. And lastly, the effector is going to be the circulatory system, the muscles, whatever it is that's causing these things to happen. Muscles flexing for shivering, circulatory system, reducing the diameter of your arteries in order to reduce blood flow, so on and so forth. So, circ system or muscles. So what we see is, we have the natural state of the system as the first part of this feedback loop. We have the state of the system. In this situation, we are getting cold. We are the system, and we are getting cold. We need to, one, notice that. So we need a sensor. The sensor are the nerves. The nerves say, hey, buddy, you're getting cold. Why are you standing out in the cold weather without a coat? We sense it. Our integrator, our brain, says, boy, that's not good. I need to jack up the heat. And so you go to the effector, and you begin shivering. That affects the state of the system. You start shivering. Shiver, shiver, shiver.
You're still cold, so you go inside where it's a normal warm temperature. All of a sudden, the state of the system is too warm.
Your nerves pick up on that. Goes to the integrator. The integrator affects sweat glands. You begin sweating, and you stop shivering. State of the system. You start cooling back down. Sensor back to integrator, back to effector, so on and so forth, okay? So it is a loop. Everything that happens affects the last one, okay? It just keeps going and going and going until you stop going, or whatever the system is, stops working, which is usually death. So the negative feedback systems. Body temperature and blood sugar are both good examples of negative feedback systems. Why is it called negative feedback? It's intended to maintain constant internal conditions.
What else? What do I call constant internal conditions? Homeostasis. I keep referring to it as homeostasis.
So negative feedback tends to maintain homeostasis. So if you're maintaining homeostasis, you're using negative feedback. It's called negative feedback because it has the opposite It deals with going the opposite way of whatever the effect on the state of the system is.
So if it's cold out, making you cold, you try to warm up. Okay, you're trying to get back to something.
If you are too hot, you try and cool down. So it's always trying to bring it back to the norm. Always trying to bring it back to the norm. It's trying to correct the system. It's trying to deal with problems. It reverses the changes. That's why we call it negative feedback. So I'm just saying, it is rarely, if ever, actually bad. People associate the term negative with bad.
Negative doesn't mean bad. It means it's going in the opposite direction. It is regulating a system.
Negative feedback is oftentimes good. If it allows us to maintain homeostasis, which means we're not going towards entropy, which means we're not dying, right?
We're maintaining the conditions we want. It's actually good. Very, very good.
But it is not the only feedback system we need to know. There's also a positive feedback system. Positive feedback does the same thing, only in a different way. Okay? Positive feedback escalates the change. It escalates the change. It amplifies these changes. An example would be, in an imperfect world,
I start getting hot. So my body starts shivering and pulling blood into the center. Okay? It reduces blood flow to the extremities. That would heat me up even more. And I would keep trying to heat myself up to the point where I would not be alive anymore.
That's a positive feedback system. It amplifies changes. It pushes this state, the system, further away from the normal set point.
It just keeps going away from it.
It looks like exponential growth. Exponential growth. If you've looked at that in any calculus class or algebra class, what exponential growth looks like. So it's going and going and going. There's no end to this positive feedback. It doesn't come back down. Positive feedback systems are rarely used in the body. They are in some cases, but they are rarely used in the body. Where are they used? Childbirth. You start pushing, it releases more hormones.
You push harder and more. As you push harder and more, you release more hormones to push harder and to push more.
More hormones, more, more. More hormones, more, more. So on and so forth, okay? I can only get so tall, right, before I'm jumping. Eventually, you get rid of those kids, right? They come out. And your body says, I no longer have things to push. The system goes back to them. Stops. This whole system just stops. It just goes away. So it escalates. That's the important part. So childbirth is a good example of positive feedback. It's one of the few examples I have in the body. Important thing to kind of just jot down to the side. So childbirth, positive feedback. I have a whole lot of examples for positive feedback. So I'm going to go a little bit outside and talk about population growth. Okay, so we're outside the body. We only had one for inside the body, only one for us. Now we're talking about outside the body. Population growth, exponential population growth, like what we see with humans. Up until about 1700s, we've got a fairly flat line. Over here in the 1800s, we get to about the Industrial Revolution, and all of a sudden, pow, right through the roof. All right, right through the roof.
Exponential population growth
is an example I'll use for positive feedback. As we get more people being born,
as they come to sexual maturity, they can hence have children, right? So if you have more children than you are, right, if you're a husband and a wife and you have three kids, then you're actually adding
to the population, not maintaining. We'll talk more about that later, okay? So, and then those three kids have three kids each, and those three kids have three kids each, and those three kids, it starts rolling and rolling and rolling, okay? And going way, 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 way up, all right? Exponential growth. Another one is species extinction. It's actually the opposite direction of positive feedback. So most times when we think about positive feedback, we see that positive feedback escalating until it goes through the roof. Number of people over time, boom, through the roof. In an extinction event, number of birds, we start dying off, we meet this threshold, crash. Eventually there aren't enough breeding pairs, and we start escalating down through the floor.
We hit the floor, we're all dead. We're extinct. So the things we see are massive population gains, massive population losses.
These are the other examples of positive feedback. What I want you to remember is that positive feedback does not mean it's only growing. It can also be deteriorating. Not just growth, it can also be deteriorating. So just because they're using the terms positive and negative does not mean that they are positive or negative. The negative feedback refers to what that external factor is doing.
The negative feedback, it's affecting the system. You are going against, fighting against that external thing to bring it back to the norm. Positive feedback is saying, sure, whatever change we're doing, let's do that. Okay? Positive feedback just agrees with whatever's happening on the outside.
Negative feedback doesn't. It doesn't agree. Negative feedback tries to get back to the normal state. Ocotillo. So, this is a desert planet. We're going to look at some Ocotillos
in a lab here shortly, if they hadn't destroyed them all in the construction.
So, it grows leaves just after rainy seasons, okay? And then it drops those leaves after it's done a whole lot of photosynthesis. Because that photosynthesis, we were building, right? It takes a lot of water. We had to build these, we had to break some down, we had to build stuff up. We're running out of water. So the water conservation of this plant is an example of either A or B.
Who thinks it's negative feedback? Who thinks it's positive feedback? Anybody? So is it losing more and more and more and more water?
Is it escalating and crashing? Or is it gaining water, something happening, going down, stopping leaf, getting rid of the leaf so it can't do any more photosynthesis, so it can maintain a normal?
Negative feedback.
Okay.
Negative feedback. Once it's lost the water, though, it has to wait until the next rain.
That's true. But it's worried about keeping water as close to a normal state as possible. Its normal state is low water.
Okay. So, yeah, it just photosynthesizes, go up, and then cut it off.
Right. So, with the Ocotillo, let me see if I've got space to draw.
Okay.
So we've got, let's look at it this way. H2O, fine. So we start off with the Ocotillo having low water conditions. Rain, water goes up. Add leaves, water goes down. H2O critical point. H2O critical point, drop leaves, balance out. So that's where we're dropping the leaves, we're balancing out, we're back at that same normal state.
So the negative feedback is Matt's concern primarily with maintaining constant and positive and care about constant.
Exactly.
Goes
positive
goes
just goes.
Together.
Yep.
Okay.
Yep. So positive is sometimes very dangerous.
Did you have a
So, like, if the
Ocotillo
was just keep running and keep running and just wait for the next rain, that would be positive feedback.
Right. Keep trying, and it would positively feedback right through the ground, right? It would just keep using up water and right through the ground and kill itself. So that's why it's got to drop those leaves. Does that make sense for everybody?
Before I continue on, there's something on here. Water to operate, wait once a year, twice a year, gets water.
Okay.
I didn't
know where you were going with that. I see where you're going with that. That works. That's what most desert plants will do. They'll store a long period of time.
So positive feedback doesn't worry about maintaining
homeostasis? No, positive feedback does not worry about maintaining homeostasis whatsoever. It's actually going away from the normal. Positively, absolutely growing. Okay, going crazy. Next, let's try and figure out the effector. You know what? I'm going to continue on. So the effector here is going to be E, both B and D. Okay, things that get rid of it, the mechanism that holds the leaves to the plant. We sense that we're losing too much water. The integrator makes us go, okay, we need to have an effect. That effect is dropping these leaves. The mechanism dropping the leaves is the actual effector doing that work. And it also has the effector when water levels get too high, it sends out leaves. It builds leaves. Okay, so that is also an effector. Effectors are where you get the physical effect. Sensors are where you're sensing something happening. And integrators are where you're making the decision on what we're going to do.
So just too hot than your human body, the sweat glands would be the infection?
Yes, yes. The final thing that you do.
Yeah.
If you're sweating, you sweat limb.
Sure.
Absolutely. So a female becomes amenorrheic, stopping the menstrual cycle. Okay? She's stopping the menstrual cycle because her body is deprived of food. Menstrual cycle takes a lot of energy. You're building a whole, quite a few layers of cells all at once. When you reduce the amount of energy you're intaking, you can sometimes stop menstruating. Okay? That's not a good thing. That means that you're very low on energy. Her body's energy stores. She is, so what do people think? Negative feedback. She's trying to maintain homeostasis. Okay, so energy, same constant. She's not eating. Okay, her body doesn't menstruate because it wants to try and keep that energy level from getting any lower. If it didn't care, if it menstruated anyway, it would go this way, and that would be positive feedback. Okay, get worse. Number one, negative. Number two, runner breathes more heavily when exercising. So, O2 in blood. So we've got O2 in blood over time. Exercise, we normally have this level. We exercise. We're going to pull more oxygen out because we need to access more energy. So what do? Breathe more heavily. Boom. Come back up and get back to that level. So what would that be? Negative feedback. Last one. You see this right now. Lower unemployment causes increased labor costs, which raises the price on goods, causing inflation, which causes wages to increase, which leads to increased inflation. Positive feedback. All right? Inflation leads to inflation. That's why the comic books that were 5 cents when your parents were a kid are now $3 or $4 or whatever. Inflation is always increasing. The positive feedback, and it just keeps going. We've talked about positive and negative feedback. We've got a general idea on each. Whenever something's going through homeostasis, what is it? Negative feedback. If it's something maintaining internal condition, it's almost always, 99% of the time, awake, always, negative feedback. It's going to be negative feedback. You've got to get back to that norm. Positive feedback is the escalation, getting away from the norm, going way, way out there. Blood flow. So how did I'm going to take the word blood flow off there and just say anatomy in general. Anatomy and physiology in general. How did early researchers figure this stuff out? We grabbed corpses. We grabbed dead people. How do we get these corpses? We dug them up. These guys are grave robbers. Okay? They are. They're wild guys doing crazy things. You dissect the dead. So we had Galen. Okay? Another thing we notice in these time frames, a lot of these guys are like Greek and Romans. One of the really interesting things that you see in anatomy are things named after things in the gladiatorial arena. So once you know that these guys love to watch the gladiators, you notice that they start naming things after them. It can be very interesting on how to remember things. Like why this is called the gladiolus. This is where they want the gladiators to hit. Okay? Why that body in the sternum is? Because if you stab that, what's behind this? Heart. So what happens if you stab this and pull the sword out? So, very, very interesting on the floors of the gladiatorial arenas, right? So aim for this, is what they're saying. So to Galen, blood ebbed and flowed through the veins, arteries, and heartland at times. Galen thought everything just went in and out. He thought it was like the tides through the body. Didn't matter if it was an artery, didn't matter if it was a vein, it's just in and out. Okay, that's as far as we're going to go with Galen on that part. When it reached the extremities, it goes away. New blood was made by mixing spirits, these magical spirits, that are contained in the heart, the lungs, and the liver. He saw there was quite a bit of vasculature to the liver. Okay, makes sense for us because we know that's where we do a lot of detox, deal with a lot of problems. So he saw a lot of vasculature to the liver. He saw a lot of vasculature to the lungs. Makes sense because that's where we're oxygenating blood. And of course, a whole lot of blood, a whole lot of vasculature right to the heart. Okay? So he thinks that's where we're mixing these things and making this magic blood that goes out and disappears once it gets to our extremities. He also thought that blood seeped through the septum, separating the ventricles. That big, thick, muscular wall we saw, he thought it just flowed right there. It could go in and out, it didn't matter. It could go through that. Sure, it's magic spirits. It'll be fine. Come on. Right? I mean,
Don't you guys know anything about magic spirits? Later on, people started thinking, hey, you know, planets circulate. Maybe blood does that. Well, sometimes you've got to be careful with that, okay? Bruno suggested this, and they burned him. You're a heretic. And they burned him, okay? That's how science could end up going at that point in time. You had to be really careful how you presented new ideas.
Still do.
And at a later time, okay, only 7 years later, guy says mostly the same thing, William Harvey, doesn't get set on fire. Guess he should have just waited a few more years. So William Harvey talks about blood flowing in a circular path from heart to arteries to capillaries to veins to heart, okay? Right to left, so on and so forth, okay? He's got our system pretty well down. This is in 1657. Capillaries are extremely difficult to see. In fact, they're microscopic because they're letting one cell through. Okay? You have to see them through a microscope. They're very, very small usually, those capillaries. All right? Remember on the video we watched today, we had the big heart muscles, or 2 days ago, we had the big heart muscles pumping. Okay? We had that little tube beside them with the single red blood cell going through each time. That's the size of those capillaries, okay, and how that oxygen's diffusing out. He couldn't see them, but he said, I think they're there. I hypothesize they're there. He used evidence. He did the math. For what Galen was saying. Suppose the left ventricle holds about 2 ounces of blood. He took a heart, filled the ventricle with liquid, found out about how much that was, 2 ounces, and said, okay, if your heart beats 72 times a minute, there's 60 minutes in an hour, there are 24 hours in a day, but in 1 hour, you would have to pump and create 8,640 ounces of blood. That's 540 pounds of blood an hour if Galen's right. So supposedly you could cut somebody and they would bleed out 540 pounds of blood in Galen's eyes. Those are some busy spirits. Those guys are busy. They're working hard. So if you did the math, and that's that quantitative evidence. Quantitative. Observational. He noticed there were one-way valves between these atria and these ventricles. We're stopping blood flow. We're keeping blood flow in certain particular places. He looked at the septum, and he said, whoa, Galen, I don't see any pores here. He sees the pulmonary circuit. He sees the body, the systemic circuit. So he says, you know what? He sees these two totally different circuits. He says, you know what? I'm going to test the seepage between these ventricles. He filled one with a colored liquid, the other one with nothing, held them up, and the liquid didn't go from one side to the other. No seepage. Did it the other way? No seepage. He probed the right ventricle, and it went up to the lungs. The mechanical probe from the right atrium easily went into the right ventricle. There we go. And when he filled these things with water, and he tried his best to push them backwards, they would not go from the ventricle back to the atria, or from the atria back to the lung. He couldn't force water backwards. He could force it backwards. But he couldn't force it backwards from the ventricle to the atria. Okay? He could not do it. Sat there, push on. We also have something that I haven't described yet in our cardio lab. We have one-way valves in our veins. We see these most prominently in our legs. In lab today, I talked about the great saphenous vein. I don't think I did on Monday whatsoever about bypasses, using it for bypasses. Did I? Okay. You have to turn this vein around when you're using it for a bypass. Why? Because the blood has to flow up. It's not magical, it's liquid. Gravity will pull it down. So what does it have to do? It has to move up and get notched somewhere. Move up and get notched somewhere. That's where these one-way valves come in. So, this vein has a valve system like that. So the blood will push up and these valves will flop down. And then when it stops being pulled up, they'll come back down and these will flop down and flop open and flop close. So the blood can't flow back down. So you're ratcheting blood up through your body back up to your heart. It's always going up. Remember that arteries don't have that. Arteries don't have that because you're just pushing. Okay, pushing it out. So those, we don't care how fast they get to the feet.
Let them go. Okay? But the veins, we want them to keep coming up to the heart. Otherwise, we have big purple feet. Okay? Big purple feet. And you see that. You can see that in some cases in medicine for different disease states. Comparative. We saw, and I talked about that, I know, in Latin. So, we've seen that left side is always a bigger ventricle. It's always bigger, stronger ventricle pumping more. Why is that? It's pumping to the body. It's got to push blood all the way up to the brain. We don't want that right side, that right ventricle, to be as large because we don't want to power out blood right through the lungs, right? We talked about that with the racehorses, right? We don't want to send blood out through our lungs. We don't want to force it because those capillaries are very thin. Okay, they're very, very thin. Our body capillaries, we have a whole lot of them. And we have other stress, or we have other things pushing back against them. We have the materials. The lungs are just these big puffs, these big open spaces. So if we push against that little plastic, little like lining of plastic basically, like little saran wrap, we'll pop right through it. So that's why we don't want really strong right ventricles, but really strong left ventricles, because we've got to force that blood all the way up here. And gravity wants to keep pulling that blood down. So the first, I'll do a quick review when we come in tomorrow of all these people. You will need to have an idea of who they are for the exam. And I will start off going through the vertebrates, through the vertebrates and the vertebrate heart. All right? I'm sorry. Monday.
What exam?
The third exam that's far, far away. Yeah. Two more weeks, 3 weeks, something like that. 2 or 3 weeks. Yeah.